Explaining Killing and Mass Atrocities in Warfare. Of significance here is the ability of the individual to kill when called upon to do so by the community or the state. How are we to understand the willingness of people to kill on such a large scale? Much has been written by social scientists and social psychologists about why people, seemingly uncoerced, take part in killing, especially when it comes to mass murder and genocide. Perpetrators' studies, as it is known, is now a growing field, but it can largely be categorized under three theories: structural, intentional, and situational. Structural implications emphasize the role of bureaucracies in organizing the killing. The individual killer assumes a subordinate role in the framework. In the case of the Holocaust, the destruction of the Jews became an administrative problem, a process which apparently neutralized moral concerns. Killing becomes part of a bureaucratic process and is thus impersonal. I think the problem with this approach is the assumption that the bureaucrat is completely distanced and that the decisions are impersonal. But we don't know if this is entirely the case. More work needs to be done on the bureaucratic mechanisms of killing. International cultural accounts do the exact opposite and insist on the choice of individuals in taking part in mass murder. Perpetrators often do so uncoerced and with a certain degree of enthusiasm, but there is more to it than that. The philosopher Thomas Nagel puts it this way: what we do is also limited by the opportunities and choices with which we are faced, and these are largely determined by factors beyond our control. Someone who was an officer in a concentration camp might have led a quiet and harmless life if the Nazis had never come to power in Germany. Nagel goes on to speculate that Germans under Nazi rule did no more than fail a test of civic courage. I imagine that most people would probably fail that test under the same circumstances. But then most of us will never find ourselves in a situation where we must make a choice between killing and not killing. What we want to try and understand is not only why people kill, but also why a minority refuse to carry out the order to do so. Situational explanations attempt to account for the murdering individual by considering how people react in certain environments. Central to this approach is conformity of behavior. In that context, social scientists often point to classic experiments of Stanley Milgram, in which the subjects absolve themselves of all responsibility by obeying authority, or of Philip Zimbardo, in which the subjects overwhelmingly conform to the behavior of the group in which they find themselves. There is an ongoing debate about just how valid these experiments are in explaining the formation of a murderous mentality, but the 20th century is replete with examples. These are all valid approaches, but it is also worth looking at other understandings of massacre and atrocities in history. Massacres do not inevitably lead to genocide, but there can be no genocide without incremental massacres. The first use of the term massacre in France in the 16th century came from the name for a butcher's knife, the massacreur. There is, nevertheless, a lack of consensus as to what constitutes a massacre. The preeminent scholar in the field, Jacques Semmelin, defines massacre as a form of action that is most often collective and aimed at destroying non-combatants. However, this does not consider the blurred lines between combatant and non-combatant in the many theaters of war, civilians who killed combatants, or the number of victims necessary to make up a massacre. Let's broaden that definition then to include one group's intent to kill another group, generally armed and of any age or sex, for racial, religious, political, or cultural motives. Common to massacre as with all forms of mass killing, is a sense of superiority, racial, religious, cultural, or political, among the perpetrators over the victims. It is why massacres are often found in colonial or frontier settings. Atrocities often come from a position of weakness, that is, they are a response to the perpetrator's own fear of being attacked. Violence as a defense mechanism that had little to do with ideology or excessive aggression. The killing can come from below, soldiers or settlers seeking revenge for the death of their own, or it can be ordered from above as a strategy to instill fear in civilians so that they think twice before resisting occupation. In some instances, massacres are deliberately carried out to force people to flee. Think of the massacre of the Palestinians carried out by Jewish forces during the 1947-48 war in Palestine. Battlefield atrocities have also been a part of warfare since humans began killing one another in a concerted, relatively organized fashion several thousand years ago. No army in history has been wholly innocent of the charge. The use of massacre in the modern world is hardly a new development, and is strikingly like the use of massacre by all states in the pre-modern era as a political and military tool to enforce obedience from rebellious lower orders. This was once considered entirely acceptable from a political and a military perspective, even if the excesses which the military were sometimes guilty of shocked elite sensibilities. In Europe, it was only in the 19th century that massacres of civilians by soldiers began to be hidden from the public view, although they continued to occur in warfare throughout the 19th and 20th centuries and in recent wars in the Middle East. Indeed, massacres are likely to occur wherever occupying troops interact with civilian populations. In the modern era, ethnicity, and to a lesser extent religion, is a determining factor in whether one survives a conflict. This was certainly the case for the First and Second World Wars. Putting to one side for a moment the debates over German geopolitical ambitions, the First World War was also very much about nationalist and ethnic conflict in Central and Eastern Europe. The kinds of tensions that were unleashed among hugely diverse ethnic and religious populations with the collapse of the European empires, Russian, German, Austrian, and Ottoman, in the contested Eastern European borderlands, existed before the First World War, but they were contained by the European imperial states. In the aftermath of the war, however, the social and political instability in these regions spiraled into ongoing political violence. The historian Timothy Snyder suggests that if you draw a triangle from Estonia in the north of Europe to encompass Yugoslavia and Ukraine in the south, what he calls the Bloodlands, you were much more likely to suffer a violent death there than in any other region of the world, at least in the first half of the 20th century. Omar Bartov and Eric Wheats refer to these regions, extending from the Baltic to the Black Sea, as the Shatter Zone or the European Rimlands. Admittedly, not all the killing that took place was racially motivated. A good deal of it was carried out by the Soviets for ideological reasons, but much of it derived from pre-existing ethnic hatreds. The Second World War, again putting to one side German and Japanese geopolitical ambitions, was driven in part by racial ideology. This was the case for the Nazis in Europe, particularly in Eastern Europe, but it was also the case in the Pacific, where Europeans and other Asian forces fought the Japanese, who dehumanized their enemies, considered themselves superior, and imposed a Greater Asia co-prosperity sphere, which inflicted desolation on the Asian countries they occupied. The Japanese occupation and the mistreatment of civilians under their rule led to deaths of around 6 million people, including Chinese, Koreans, Malaysians, Indonesians, Filipinos, and Indochinese, among others. Allied troops often regarded the Japanese in the same way that Germans regarded Russians, as an Untermenschen, subhumans. General Thomas Blamey, who commanded the Australian forces in New Guinea during the Second World War, told his troops that their forces were a cross between the human being and the ape, vermin, something primitive that had to be exterminated to preserve civilization. Such sentiments were also widespread among Americans, furious at what they considered to be the treachery and cowardice of Pearl Harbor, such that boiling the flesh of enemy skulls to make souvenirs was not an uncommon practice. Allied soldiers in the Pacific collected ears, bones, teeth, and skulls as souvenirs or trophies, a practice which, according to some soldiers' memoirs, was widespread. The Japanese in China did the same. Nothing comparable among combatants took place in Europe during the war, although German soldiers were very much in the habit of taking trophy photos of the humiliation of Jews and of killings and massacres. Consider the photo which shows Natalie Nickerson, 20, gazing at a skull, reportedly of a Japanese soldier, sent to her from New Guinea by her boyfriend serving in the Pacific. Is the skull illustrative of a kind of gruesome battlefield humour that men rely on to get through the horror of war, or does this signify a certain pride in their military success? We don't know who the Japanese soldier was, how the remains got into the hands of the Navy lieutenant, or indeed what the young woman thought of the whole thing. Did the collector have to boil the flesh of a decomposed head? Nor did we know what became of the skull, or indeed of the young woman herself, or the man who sent it to her as a gift. We only know that Life magazine's editor wrote about the photo taken by Ralph Crane when they featured it in a Picture of the Week in a May 1944 issue. When we said goodbye 2 years ago to Natalie Nickerson, 20, a war worker of Phoenix, Arizona, a big, handsome Navy lieutenant promised her a Jap. Last week, Natalie received a human skull, autographed by her lieutenant and 13 friends, and inscribed, "This is a good Jap, a dead one, picked up on the New Guinea beach." Natalie, surprised at the gift, named it Tojo. The armed forces, Life pointedly noted, disapprove strongly of this sort of thing. In Europe, Germans, many imbued with the ideology of the master race, fought slaves and Bolsheviks, and in the Nazi mindset, Bolshevism was a Jewish ideology in what was a war of racial annihilation. Casualty figures from the Eastern Front, compared with other theatres of operation, demonstrate the scale and the nature of the destruction. The total Allied losses, including both civilians and military personnel, in both the Pacific and European theatres, were around 1.5 million people. That's a lot of people, but compare it to the German losses of around 10 million and the Soviet losses of around 27 million, the majority of them civilians. The number of people killed in France during the war represented about 1% of the pre-war population. In Poland, anywhere between 16 and 20% of the population was killed. There was not a family in Poland that was not directly touched by the war. In France and in the Netherlands, only one town in each country was razed by the SS in retreat. In Russia, by contrast, more than 3,000 villages were wiped from the map, and that is not counting Ukraine and other Eastern European states. The suffering in Eastern Europe was immense, and compounded a pre-war history of Soviet political violence and famine. It would be a mistake to think that the kinds of massacre and atrocity associated with the Eastern Front during the Second World War were in some way unusual. That kind of extreme violence is all too common in warfare. A photo appeared in Life magazine and was taken by a U.S. Army photographer, Ronald L. Habriel, during the My Lai massacre of 1968 in Vietnam. It shows mostly dead women and children on a road. The war reporter, Seymour Hersh, broke the story on the Associated Press wire service about 1 year after the massacre, and the newspapers soon followed. The My Lai was the deadliest of several massacres committed by American troops that we know of. Many others may have gone undetected and unreported. Massacre studies often focus on the victims, but what of the killers? Private First Class Fernando Simpson was a black American soldier who took part in the My Lai massacre when 347 Vietnamese civilians were shot by C Platoon, led by Lieutenant William L. Calley, Jr. Some of the women were gang-raped and killed, and their bodies mutilated. Simpson, who spoke openly about his behavior in later years, was so overcome with guilt that he committed suicide in 1997. Not all killers behave that way, or feel remorse, or are visibly marked by what they have done and what they have seen. Take, for example, a former Khmer Rouge prison guard who was interviewed in his home while he bounced a baby on his knee. The man was responsible for the deaths of 7 pregnant women and is accused of killing 2,000 people with a farm implement. And yet, on that day, in his house, he was a grandfather, a kindly man, seemingly no different from any other Khmer peasant. His victims, on the other hand, knew him as a killer. Reinhard Hendrick, the Nazi responsible for the coordination of the Holocaust, was, according to his biographer, Robert Gerwirth, an extremely sensitive violinist who displayed a tenderness and sentimentality that deeply impressed his audiences. That might be true, but as recent research has shown, the SS and their police auxiliaries willingly participated in rituals of rape, sexual humiliation, and torture, often fueled by alcohol, before, during, and after mass shootings in Eastern Europe. Terror bombing. Atrocities against civilians were not only widespread, but they were also systematic during the 20th century. Take the Allied destruction during the Second World War of civilian cities, such as Dresden, Hamburg, Tokyo, Hiroshima, and Nagasaki. Cities have always been besieged and bombarded, but the invention of the aeroplane in the early 20th century allowed belligerent forces to bomb cities from a distance as never before. The first Hague Peace Conference in 1899 enshrined the principle that civilian cities could be attacked. From that time on, the air war techniques used by European armies were first perfected in the colonies, not only killing civilians but also destroying their homes, crops, animals and livelihoods. The first bomb dropped from a plane was in Tripoli in 1911, when Italians bombed a Turkish encampment. The French followed suit in Morocco in 1911. After the First World War, the British in Iraq, and on the Afghan northwest frontier in the 1920s, the Italians in Ethiopia, and the Germans in Spain during the Civil War, all experimented with terror bombing, including the use of phosgene and mustard gas attacks. Terror bombing is designed to break civilian morale, a goal that has never been achieved. In reality, it's designed to kill as many people as possible. Terror bombing reached its peak during the Second World War, resulting in anywhere between 300,000 and 600,000 civilian casualties in Germany. Many Britons were in favour of the reprisal bombing of German cities. The goal was to raze completely all cities with a population of over 100,000 people. A similar policy was practiced against Japan. Many Americans not only enthusiastically supported the bombing of Japanese cities, but some were in favor of the extermination of all Japanese. In the modern era, this kind of mass killing by air power is no longer considered acceptable. Although the annihilation of humanity was an ever-present possibility during the Cold War, and still is, and has been replaced by the precision bombing of military targets through so-called smart bombs and drones, there are two ways of understanding the mass killings that took place in the first half of the 20th century. The first is to compartmentalize each event, to examine them within a specific historical context, place and time, and to explain each event as the result of the development of a particular national international history or a particular culture. The second is to examine mass murder as a European-wide event taking place simultaneously across a multinational landscape and with the support of many kinds of people. Viewed this way, the focus is on form over context. It is what genocide scholars often do when they discuss the theoretical implications of mass killing. Both approaches are valid, and both approaches yield interesting insights. Terrorism. If the state has been responsible for the greatest number of deaths in the modern world, violence can also be used as a means by organized groups to achieve political, religious, or ideological ends through terrorism. All revolutionaries or terrorists who wish to subvert or violently overthrow the existing social order transform violence into a sacred, if not a sublime, device. Anarchists, Marxists, jihadists, and the Western military have that in common. The revolutionary or freedom fighter willing to kill his or her opponents, the suicide bomber willing to kill and die for the cause, and the Western world's readiness to use force to overthrow states, such as Afghanistan and Iraq, to bring about democratic reform, all valorize violence as a necessary, and not necessarily evil, means to a just end. Radical political parties and organizations are willing to use violence to achieve their goals, often at the expense of innocent civilians. In fact, civilians often become a target in their struggle to create a new and better society. So, what is terrorism? The term has evolved significantly over the past two centuries. Up until the 19th century, terror had only ever been implemented by the state on individuals. Think of the terror during the French Revolution or spectacular public executions. That flipped when the terms terrorism and terrorist were used to describe Russian anarchists in the 1870s and 1880s, bent on overthrowing the Tsarist regime. It was clandestine, it was political, it was violent, and it was revolutionary. Terror came from below and not from above. In the 20th century, groups that most typified that kind of violence were the Algerian Resistance Movement, the Irish Republican Army, and the Palestine Liberation Organization, PLO, including the many offshoots that came out of these movements like the Red Army faction in Germany or the Red Brigade in Italy. The difference between 19th and 20th and 21st century terrorists is that the former targeted political elites, while the latter target ordinary people. The PLO was involved in some spectacular terrorist attacks, such as the hijacking and detonation of four planes that were bound for New York City and London in 1970, and the Munich massacre of 1972. Terrorism is both politics and theatre. Nevertheless, state-directed terror, think of Augusto Pinochet's Chile, continued and continues to exist wherever dictatorships and dictators rule by violence and intimidation. The term terrorism has always had negative connotations and is often used by governments to delegitimize different kinds of political dissent or any kind of radical attacks on government and capitalism. Militant vegans and anti-abortion crusaders, who sometimes use the term genocide to describe industrial farming and who raid industrial pig farms or abattoirs, have been dubbed terrorists by certain sections of the conservative establishment. That's nonsense on both counts and highlights the kinds of misuse or overuse that terms of violence can encourage. The term terrorism can be both an epithet and a category of analysis, but the old adage, one man's freedom fighter is another man's terrorist, underlines how difficult it is to come to an objective definition of the term. Terrorists are called that by others, not themselves. Some argue, however, that it's possible to arrive at a definition of terrorism based upon accepted international laws and principles regarding what is and is not permissible in conventional wars. This can range from assassinations of public figures to random acts of civilians. Think of the bombings in Madrid in 2004, in London in 2005, the attacks in Mumbai in 2008, and in Paris in 2015. But there are problems with definitions, which now tend to exclude state-based actors. To paraphrase Noam Chomsky, it's hard to find a definition that excludes the terror we carry out against them and includes the terror that they carry out against us. It is not unheard for the governments to use, and indeed to exaggerate, the threat of terrorism to push through laws that restrict individual freedoms. In Australia, for example, where billions of dollars have been spent on bolstering national security and fighting the war on terror since 2001, a total of 12 people have been killed in terror-related incidents, including the suspected terrorists. This doesn't include 10 Australian killed on the 11th of September 2001, or the 88 Australians who died in the Bali bombing of 2002. However, during that same period, over 800 women and over 250 men were killed in domestic violence incidents, while only $700 million was committed to fighting that social problem. Similar figures exist in other industrialized countries. In Britain, 126 people were killed in terrorist-related incidents between 2000 and 2018, with £2.6 billion invested in national security every year. Between 2000 and 2018, 1,870 people were killed in domestic violence-related incidents in England and Wales. Another 400 people committed suicide because of domestic abuse. There is no doubt that national security agencies throughout the world have foiled terrorist plots, although it is impossible to say how many innocent lives may have been saved as a result. One can nevertheless ask, given the disparity in the numbers of deaths, whether the response to these two problems, terrorism and domestic violence, has been proportionate. It comes back to the question of why some forms of violence are considered worse than others, but also to why and how governments, the media, and the public prioritize some forms of violence over others. Terrorist groups, like revolutionary organizations, adopt a good versus evil mentality, as do the states that fight them, that excludes those who do not belong to the group. While 19th-century terrorist groups relied on knives, guns, and dynamite to implement attacks that were dubbed propaganda of the deed, terrorist attacks in the 21st century can be far deadlier. Terrorism, after all, is meant to terrify. The Bali bombing of 2002 killed 202 people and wounded hundreds more. The Madrid train bombing of 2004 killed 191 and wounded over 1,800. The London Underground train bombing of 2005 killed 52 and injured over 700. The Mumbai terror attacks of November 2008 killed more than 174 people and wounded more than 300. In January 2015, Boko Haram attacked the town of Baga in Nigeria and killed up to 2,000 people. That same year, attacks in Paris killed 130 people and wounded 494. The media coverage of these last two events in the Western press disproportionately focused on the killings in Paris, influencing how the West feels for the victims of violence. As we can see from these examples, terrorism can be, for want of a better term, a cost-effective way of fighting a more powerful enemy, usually a state. It doesn't take much to kill hundreds of people. A simple explosive, a gun, as we saw with the mosque shootings in Christchurch, New Zealand, on the 15th of March 2019, that resulted in 51 killed and 40 injured, or a truck, as we saw with the so-called lone wolf attack in Nice in 2016, in which a troubled young man drove a truck into crowds celebrating Bastille Day, killing 86 and wounding hundreds more. However, successful terrorist organizations are more than just lone wolf attacks. They require a high degree of technological and communication skill, not to mention communities of support. That's why they are often made up of well-educated militants who come from relatively affluent backgrounds. They often develop hierarchical, professionalized, militarized organizations with elaborate structures that resemble modern bureaucracies. They also often have propaganda units in charge of recruiting and justifying their brutal acts of killing. Religion may play a role in some terrorist organizations, Al-Qaeda, for example, although there is debate about the extent to which individuals in those organizations are motivated by religious or political beliefs to commit acts of violence. This new terrorism, one that has religious inflections, makes it very distinct from past acts of terrorism. In terrorist organizations that declare themselves Islamic, martyrdom is high on the agenda. This is a relatively new approach to terror, even if the theological underpinnings of violent jihad and martyrdom are to be found in interpretations of the Quran. Modern terrorist acts have a number of features in common. They are usually spectacularly violent, a plane hijacking, an assassination of a public figure, the beheading of aid workers, or a car or suicide bombing. They are generally aimed at civilians, and they are designed to strike fear into large sections of civilian population, as well as possibly destabilize governments. The reasons terrorist attacks occur and what motivates terrorists are as varied as the individuals belonging to the militant political groups behind them. As with every form of violence, context is everything. Political scientist David Rappaport has pointed to four waves of modern terrorism. The anarchist wave, which went from the 1890s through to 1914. The anti-colonial wave, from the 1920s through to the 1960s. The new left wave, from the 1960s through to the 1990s. And the religious wave, which began with the 1979 Iran hostage crisis and persists to this day. It's during this wave that a shift took place from targeting powerful elites to aiming for mass casualties. I would add that a fifth wave appears to be emerging, right-wing extremism. A report by the United Nations Security Council's Counter-Terrorism Committee points to the dramatic rise in right-wing terrorism globally in the 5 years prior to 2020. Most of those attacks are carried out in Western countries. Think of Christchurch in New Zealand, March 2019, El Paso in the United States, August 2019, and Harley, October 2019, and Hanau, February 2020, in Germany. According to the University of Maryland's Global Terrorism Database, there were 310 terrorist attacks, resulting in 316 deaths in the United States from 2015 to 2019. Most originated with right-wing extremists. This is now a global problem. The decline of killing in warfare. The ability to kill in warfare increased dramatically between the first use of the Gatling gun in 1862 during the American Civil War and the testing of thermonuclear weapons in 1952. During that 90-year period, the world experienced gas deployed on the battlefield during the First World War and in the death camps during the Second World War, not to mention the subsequent development of chemical and biological weapons, as well as carpet bombing and the strafing of civilians by planes. There was the invention of tanks, flamethrowers, and napalm, the extermination of the enemy by fire by other means, torpedoes and submarines, and more recently drones, all capable of inflicting severe loss of life. It is often thought that chemical weapons were only used during the First World War, but in fact, incendiary bombs were also chemical weapons that caused far more deaths during the Second than the First World War. Around 350,000 people suffocated to death in firestorms during the Second World War, compared to 90,000 killed by incendiary bombs during the First World War. Not to mention their deployment in conflicts in the Middle East in the 21st century. What is interesting is that the belligerent powers did not use newly developed nerve gas during the Second World War despite having had access to it. It was possibly an early example of mutual deterrence. The Washington Conference of 1921 prohibited the use of gas in warfare. But during the interwar period, there were those, such as Captain B. H. Liddell Hart, who went on to become a military historian, who argued that gas was a more humane weapon than bullets or bombs, also implying that it would also be a cost-effective method of putting down rebellions in the colonies. Some figures of the two world wars help give an idea of the scale of killing. The First World War resulted in 9.7 million battle casualties. The war on the Western Front was largely a monstrous artillery duel in which millions of shells were lobbed over the trenches. German artillery alone fired over 222 million rounds. 60% of the fatalities from that war resulted from bombs or shells of one kind or another, because of which a new term was invented, shell shock. This is the beginning of the psychologizing of the consequences of modern warfare that eventually came to be recognized as post-traumatic stress disorder. For the 20th century, both the time it took to get medical care after injury and the improvement in the medical care itself considerably reduced mortality rates. For American combat injuries, in the First World War, the average time from injury to treatment was 12 to 15 hours, with a mortality rate of 8.5%. This time dropped to 6 to 12 hours in the Second World War, and mortality dropped to 5.8%. During the Korean War, often cited as an era of major advances in trauma care, treatment occurred between 2 and 4 hours of injury, with a dramatically improved mortality rate of 2.4%. In Vietnam, treatment could occur as early as 1 to 2 hours after injury, with a mortality rate levelling at 2.6%. By the time we come to the wars in the Middle East, in the first decades of the 21st century, troops could be transported to a combat support hospital in 30 to 90 minutes. At the same time, the number of battle deaths per year, worldwide, has dropped since the end of the Second World War, with just a few spikes largely explained by the Korean War, the Vietnam War from the mid-1960s to the mid-1970s, and the strife in the Balkans and among former Soviet republics in the 1990s. The pattern of the past century is that the deaths of non-combatants due to war has risen very dramatically. In the First World War, perhaps, only 10% of the 10 million who died were civilians. The number of non-combatant deaths jumped to as much as 50% of the 50 million-plus lives lost in the Second World War, and the civilian toll has kept on rising ever since. Perhaps the worst, but hardly the only, terrible example of this trend can be seen in the war in the Democratic Republic of Congo, in which over 90% of the several million dead were non-combatants. As for the number of wars fought since the end of the Second World War, the Human Security Report, looking at the period 1946 to 2008, shows a steady rise to over 50 wars per year in the early 1990s, 225 armed conflicts between 1946 and 2001, of which 115 took place in the 12-year period between 1989 and 2001. The rest of the 1990s saw a drop in conflicts of about 40%, to a great extent driven by the ending of the Balkan and post-Soviet wars, and then a pattern of rising armed conflict once again after 9/11. The number of wars is down by over one-third since the peak in the 1990s, but ongoing conflicts today are still more than double the totals seen in the years from the end of the Second World War until the mid-1950s, and are equal to the numbers of wars going on during the Vietnam era. The numbers of civil wars appears to have increased since 1945, as wars between states have become less common. It is hard to describe this, as do scholars like Steven Pinker, at a world in which war is on the wane. When the state no longer completely controls the mechanisms of violence, the results can be calamitous. And the reasons why individuals take part in acts of collective violence on behalf of the state, or in the case of terrorists, against the state? One could argue that generalizations about why people kill do not enlighten us very much. They might do so out of opportunism, careerism, or racism, or there might be questions of honor and a perverse sense of duty involved. Or they might do so out of religious or ideological conviction, or out of a confluence of these factors. Based on what we have witnessed in history over the centuries, all humans are capable of committing acts of violence, and perhaps even atrocities, in the right circumstances, if the cultural, social, religious, and political context is ripe. And we are not simply talking about young men committing acts of violence, but both genders and across all ages. Women are as capable of committing atrocities as men, as we can see with female concentration camp guards. If they don't do so on such a large scale as men, I would argue it is because violence is often tied to perverted notions of masculinity. It nevertheless begs the question, have we really changed all that much over the centuries? Or is the capacity to kill a constant that is hidden within us until it emerges in the right circumstances?